This is a Resonance FM podcast. If you enjoy the unique nature of Resonance FM programming, please support us on resonancefm.com.
So today we're lucky enough to be talking to Professor Rudy Mattei, who's Associate Professor at the University of Delaware. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be on your show.
We're celebrating now. 2 weeks ago, you had a book published in Iran.
That's right, yeah.
Please tell us.
It's a book. It's a translation of a number of my articles on socioeconomic issues in the period that I usually deal with, which is the Safavid period. It's run from the early 16th until the early 18th century in Iranian history.
The Safavid period. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, it's not as well known as the, shall we say, the adjacent empires. You know, it's sort of coexistent with the Ottomans to the west and the Mughal Empire, India, to the east, sort of sandwiched in between. But equally important, certainly in the sense that both the Mughals and the Ottomans were very much influenced by Iranian models and paradigms and certainly literature and language and so forth. So it's, culturally speaking, a very important state. It came to an end in the early 18th century because it was overrun by Afghan tribesmen coming from the east. And it actually originated as a sort of a messianic state. And it's a very important one for Iranian history because it's really the beginning of Iran as a Shi'i country. Iran, as I'm sure you know, is the only country in the world that has Shi'i Islam as a state religion. And that goes back to the Safavids, to the first Shah, who proclaimed Shi'ism as a state religion in 1501.
How do you see, as a historian, the difference between Shi'as and Sunnis?
Well, it's somewhat similar to the division and the schism between Protestantism and Catholicism. Catholicism, of course, there are many, many differences. But shorthand, it's not a bad comparison, I would say. You know, it's been articulated and used and abused for propagandistic purposes. Wars have been fought over it. But it is ultimately, you know, two sides of the same coin, you know, with a number of differences. It can either be minimized or maximized or magnified according to political circumstances.
So your book that you've just released, what's that really dealing with?
Well, that is, it really goes back to the fact that Iranian historians don't have access to many of the sources that are available for the period. They mostly have to deal with Persian sources, which come in the form of court chronicles, and they don't deal with the issues that I like to deal with, namely social history and economic history, in combination with political and diplomatic history. So they end up writing mostly about, you know, literature and political events, sort of high politics. And so these articles, these four articles chosen by this colleague of mine to translate, really deal with issues like coinage, you know, looking at coins can tell you about history, the traffic in gold and silver coins all the way from Europe to India with Iran, sort of the conduit in between, and really the interaction between politics and economic and social issues on the basis of sources, again, that are not readily available to Iranians because for half of my source material, I go to the Dutch sources, you know, the East India Company sources, the English sources, the same type of sources, you know. They were both very active in the Persian Gulf in the 17th century. Missionary documents, which are all in Italian or in Latin and Spanish and Portuguese. Russian documents, which are also not easily available to Iranians given their limited language skills. So I bring all these things together and so this colleague translated these articles to just, you know, give an example to Iranian scholars, colleague scholars, of what is possible beyond what they are, you know, typically doing in terms of their research.
Well, you've certainly studied this subject. You've done a BA and MA in the Netherlands, and you studied in Tehran in 76 and 77. You've done a PhD in Islamic studies at UCLA, and you're a member of the American, Numismatics Association.
Yeah, I was actually a fellow there for one summer, which awakened my interest because, you know, they train you as sort of a specialist in the 3 months you're there, the 2 months. It awakened my interest in coins as a source of fascinating information about history.
That's what numismatic means, isn't it? It's about coins.
That's right, yeah, the study of coins.
Okay, so the book that you wrote, The Pursuit of Pleasure, Drugs and Stimulants in Iranian History, 1500 to 1900, that was maybe a bit of a departure from your usual subject matter. Wouldn't you say?
Well, Yes and no. No in the sense that I like to sort of combine, again, political and social history. I like to look at the grand sweep of history, sort of detect patterns of continuity. And yes, in the sense that until then I hadn't written about it, which is actually not even true, because my first foray into this subject goes back to, I think, 1996, and it's actually very interesting because it goes back to a conference that was held at the Wellcome Institute in London, organized by the late lamented Roy Porter, famous historian of medicine, among other things. But he was doing a conference on, you know, I think it was just on opium or drugs in general, in a world context. And he had asked my advisor to go and to give a paper, and I was her research assistant at the time, and she asked me to do some preliminary work about this, and I did. And then she said, well, this, I can't really improve on what you've done. Why don't you go in my place? And I did. And out of it grew this interest in drugs, you know, because I gave this paper on on tea and coffee, the transition from coffee to tea in Iran. Iran used to be a coffee-drinking country in the 17th and 18th century, and all of a sudden in the 19th century it turns into a tea-drinking country. So fascinating development, and I was trying to figure out why and under what circumstances this happens. So then I ended up expanding from this into opium and wine, and I discovered enormous amount of material on this topic. And so book grew out of this.
So it's not grown out of personal interest, as in you interested in drugs,
well,
per se?
Yes and no, again. I mean, when I was in Iran, I smoked my, you know, portion of opium with people, with friends, which is, you know, still quite common. Actually, still is very common, even though heroin is mostly replaced it. So that was sort of a personal, well, shall we say, attachment or an involvement.
You've got to have done it to have written about it. It's only fair.
Right, exactly.
And so a lot of people have asked me, actually, when we've been discussing, what's the difference between opium and heroin?
Well, opium is a natural product, and heroin is a derivative, and it's a chemical product.
So it's a chemical copy of opium?
Right, yeah.
Oh, right, I thought that opium was in heroin.
Yeah, there is opium in heroin, as far as I know, even though I'm not a specialist on heroin at all. I've never used it,
yeah.
And I know very little about it. And see, my book also stops in 1900.
Yeah.
So, you know, it really stops with sort of the traditional drugs and stimulants, and certainly doesn't include anything like heroin.
But it's very interesting now, when we look at Afghanistan, American soldiers are allowing the opium production because they have been forbidden from getting involved in the opium production, but it's funding the people that they are fighting in Afghanistan. So it's
right.
A really weird impasse, wouldn't you say? The American soldiers are there trying to keep the Taliban back and fight them, yet they're not allowed to touch the opium crops, which fund the Taliban up there.
Right, yeah, well, that is interesting. Of course it is interesting. And there's actually an analogy with Iran to some extent, which goes back to the 19th century, because opium came in massively as a crop in the late 19th century, substituting for grain, because it was much more profitable for peasants. So they began to grow papaver instead of cereals, and it actually led to a huge increase in addiction, and also to a different type of addiction. See, in these countries, both in Iran and Afghanistan, opium has always been sort of, you know, woven into the texture of life. It was never really an issue, never a problem. It was like wine in France, you know,
yeah.
You took it in sort of moderation, and you'd live with it. And, you know, there were people who abused it, but they were marginal, they were frowned upon. And but it didn't really affect the sort of the standing of the product, again, the texture of society. And so it's become a problem in modern times for a number of reasons, some of them political, and, you know, the United States being involved is a very good example of that as well.
Don't you think it would have had a massive effect on the population as a whole? For example, when they were drinking coffee, they might have been a very active society, and when they were taking opiates, then they were a very lethargic, kind of apathetic society.
Well, that's an interesting contrast. It's actually one of the things that I'm trying to sort of contest in my book, you know, this whole notion that the East is languorous and passive and, you know, addicted to opium and sort of, you know, sitting against a tree, daydreaming life away. And we in the West have always been active, you know, because we drank tea, the British, you know, and it's, or coffee, you know, and it's a real stimulant. It energizes you. I think it's more than a bit of a false distinction in the contrast. It just doesn't hold, really, in part, again, because opium, taken in moderation, actually energizes you, or at least, you know, keeps sort of depression down, and it's also an excellent medicinal agent.
Again, it was basically the home remedy for any and all ailments until modern medicine came in. And even today, almost all painkillers are still opium-based.
Really?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I thought everything was synthetic now.
Yeah, but it's still based on opium, really.
All right.
So we've never been able to substitute anything for it.
We've seen, even in England in the Victorian times, that opium was a massively addictive drug, and we had all
absolutely.
That down at the docks in London, all those opium
right.
houses. So yeah. even though it might have medicinal qualities, people don't have the inner kind of strength to hold out against it. It's obviously an addictive drug.
No, that's true. But again, as I pointed out earlier, in Iran we see a change, a transformation in the way of use, both in the quantity, you know, the amount of the usage of the drug, and you know, when it became a cash crop, it also became a lot cheaper, so more affordable for people. But more importantly, until the 19th century, opium in Iran and in much of the Middle East was actually ingested. It was not smoked. It was taken in the form of pills, small pills, you know, little balls rolled.
Yeah.
And so it was easily sort of measured and calibrated. You know, you'd take two pills in the morning before you get to work. You know, I have a chapter in my book about this, and I surmise that it comes from China, yeah, the Far East, in other words. The habit of smoking it is introduced to calamitous results, because it's much harder to, again, calibrate and sort of measure how much you take. And it also takes place in a different environment.
Yeah, it's a lot more social when you're smoking.
Yes, there is absolutely that element as part of it. There's no question about it. Sitting together, there's, you know, this convivial atmosphere. But it also takes time away from your work day, so to speak, you know, when you sit and you smoke and you drink tea with it. So the whole pattern changes.
So you're saying originally Iran was a pill-popping country before it was a shisha-smoking country?
Well, no, that's actually a simultaneous development. I discussed that in my book as well. There's a chapter on hashish and related drugs and tobacco. There's a whole chapter on tobacco, when and how it was introduced, under what forces and by whom. And one of the enigmas, of course, is precisely the hookah, the water pipe. Where does it come from and how was it introduced? Why did it gain ground in the Islamic world but not in Europe? And, you know, I have no conclusive answers to all these very intriguing questions, but I do have some speculative ones. But again, there is an overlap in the sense that the hookah was used, you know, tobacco was used in it, but from an early time, hashish was also mixed into it. So it's separate and yet related. But it is not related to opium, because opium is a different story, really.
Well, what really interests me about your book is that you could have written about drug use in any country in this period, 1600 to 1900. But at the moment, Iran has the highest amount of drug use per capita than any other country. So
yeah.
Therefore, this history would be extremely pertinent now for Iran more than any other country.
Right.
Do you ever look at the state of drug use now in your own personal interest?
Yeah, I actually was tinkering with the idea of continuing the book until today, you know, just sort of following the story to the present. But then I thought, you know, it would have to be two volumes or a 600-page book and, you know, another year or two of research, so I decided against it. But I did have an eye on the present in two ways. First of all, the idea that Iran, and as you say, it's true, and a lot of people know this, is a heavy drug-using country per capita, perhaps the highest in the world, yeah. But I wanted to discount the idea that this is sort of inherent in Iranian culture or in Middle Eastern or Islamic or Asian temperament, that it's sort of in the DNA, if you will. Because, of course, there is no society that is as heavily drug-infested as our modern Western society. You know, if you look at the incidents, not, you know, if you incorporate alcohol, certainly. I mean, you know, Britain being a very good example, one could argue. And I wanted to emphasize that. And if you read my introduction, I do touch on these issues, because I do think it's important to sort of, dispel notions.
No, we definitely agree with you. I mean, you can't go out in London without having a drink. When the current mayor of London banned drinking on the tube, there was a massive uproar because they thought they couldn't have parties on the tube anymore. And my response was, why can't you have a party without alcohol?
Well, it's a given. Yeah, there's a book just came out in Dutch for along the same, same lines, the same problem, raising the same problem, that it's not seen as a problem, but it's a huge problem, socially speaking. But no one wants to talk about it because it's not cool. And everyone participates. So that's one part of it. And the other one is, I wanted to shed some light on Iran in the long run and in the long term. You know, it comes across today as this sort of, you know, theocratic place run by the men of the cloth who have snuffed out all fun and, you know, it's this sort of dourly, dogmatic place. And first of all, it's not. It's extremely vibrant and intellectually alive and very energized and energetic. Extremely young population. We're all extremely well educated and chomping at the bit to connect with the world. Very well versed in, you know, the world, knowing much more about the West than we tend to know about them. But I wanted to sort of project it backwards. You know, I wanted to sort of lay out the two poles of Iranian life and society, because it is a country and a society and a culture that oscillates between, on the one hand, Puritanism, because it is there, you know, this sort of search for the truth, the unvarnished truth and the essence of life, if you will, and hedonism, because the Iranians are also pleasure-seeking people, and they've always been like that. You look at the poetry, and it's filled with wine and, you know, lust and you know, just a lust for life and lust in, you know, in the carnal sense of the word. So there are these two poles of that society, and they didn't come in the 1960s or something. You find this in Persian poetry in the Middle Ages, and you find it in my period.
So do you go back to Iran quite often?
Well, not as much as I would like, because it's far away and it's becoming prohibitively expensive, of course, more expensive by the day today. So, well, you know, every 2 or 3 years on average I go a conference or, you know, see friends or, you know, usually invited for something. You know, my previous book, I wrote a book about the silk trade in the same period and the Safavid period, won a prize as the best book on Iran, and they invited me for a week, you know, and I was given 12 gold coins and it was a ceremony.
Which you immediately took back and showed the American Numismatic Association.
Well, I actually don't, I'm not in touch with them anymore.
I was only joking. No, it's just interesting. So would you think it's fair to say that when you're talking about this lust for life and this this vivaciousness that you see in Iranian society and you don't want people to ignore, isn't that the same in every society? Could you say that Iranian society was more thirsting for knowledge and contact than others?
Yeah, I think there is an extra dimension to Iranian culture. Iranian culture is a culture that probes the mysteries of life. It's not for nothing that Sufism, you know, the Islamic version of mysticism, reaches its height of beauty and depth in Iranian culture and in Iranian poetry. It is a culture that probes, that's never, you know, satisfied with the answers, sort of pat answers of religion. You know, there's one God, you worship him, it's the end of the story. He created us and we, you know, we'll go back to him. You know, it's not good enough, it's not deep enough, it's not interesting enough. Iranian culture always tries to get behind the surface and it tries to sort of peel the onion to get to the core of it. And then, of course, in the end, you notice that there's nothing at the core. Maybe there's a tension between the exterior and the interior, and you're always sort of showing off, because the exterior is very important. You know, you dress up and you look beautiful and you go to parties and to see and to be seen, sort of in modern parlance. But at the same time, you know that it's all sort of surface, and that there's deep down there's a truth, and you also know you can never get there, you can never really unravel it, but it doesn't prevent you from trying. That's really what Iranian culture is all about, and therefore the search for ourselves in a way.
Do you think that drugs would play a large part in that search for ourselves?
Yeah, as a metaphor, if you look at Iranian poetry, as I said, it's filled with wine especially.
That's right.
Some hashish and opium. That's sort of a mechanism through which to achieve this goal of a transcendental state, not in sort of the hippie type of variant, but, you know, really the sort of religious quest, the quest for religious truth.
Well, interestingly, I mean, they do say that in Sufism it's misconstrued when they talk about wine and being drunk. These are just analogies. He's not really talking about being drunk.
I agree. I think it's both. And I talk about that in the book as well briefly. It's both a metaphor, you know, and an extremely rich one. You know, the ruby, a colored wine glass, you know, refracting the light of God, the sun, you know, in multifaceted colors and so forth. And then the metaphor of, you know, throwing wine on the prayer mat, you know, engaging in a worse kind of blasphemy, and thereby sort of repudiating the dour and dogmatic clerics, you know, just tell you there's only one truth. But yeah, Sufis were also drunks, there's no question about it, or at least many of them. You know, it's not just sort of an ethereal pleasure, it's also a carnal one, you know.
Then there must certainly have been some austere Sufis who abided by this Muslim law not to drink alcohol in order to have clarity of mind and spirit to seek God. And therefore, when they were talking about being drunk, it was that kind of blissful feeling that you could compare to being drunk.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a higher state. You know, you sort of leave behind the superficial reality of thou shalt not do this or that. You shall not drink. We all know that. It muddles the mind. But being a Sufi is not about that. It's about the higher quest.
Mm.
So wine becomes, you know, an agent to reach a higher plane, if you will.
Now, it's fair to say that a lot of people who are seeking higher answers take drugs because in some ways you have to lose your grip on your mind in order to find yourself.
Right, exactly.
Sometimes.
Yes, you have to sort of, you know, get free from your corporal self and the world and all its baser concerns and instincts.
Right, Rudy, do you mind if I ask you a question? Because you could really now demystify something for us that we've always wanted to know. Is what's the connection between Shiraz and wine? Because we all see in the shops Shiraz,
right.
Shiraz from Australia.
Well, it's very simple. I mean, Shiraz was the main wine-producing region in, or the capital of the main wine-producing region in Iran until, well, really the time of the Shah. So Shiraz wine was, you know, the wine of Iran. It doesn't mean it wasn't grown anywhere else.
How come they're making Shiraz in Australia now, then?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. There's a story behind it, and I once was told it, but I forget to tell you the truth.
It must be a method.
I think it was a clever businessman who sort of brought it. He may have been Iranian, I'm not sure, who just took the idea and the grape, the type of grape, to Australia and made a go of it. I'm not 100% sure, but it's something like that.
Yeah, well, we'll speculate and say it might be a method or a grape or something.
Right.
Okay, and what about sherry? Because sherry is the Iranian word for sweet wine.
Yes, I don't know. You should probably cut that from the interview because that doesn't sound very erudite.
No, it's fine if you can't know everything. There's got to be space to learn stuff in life or we'll all be finished.
Right, that's very true. Yeah.
My mum says that sherry is the word for sweet wine. And so I wondered if all alcohol originated in Iran. I suddenly started wondering if it was like the pit of the demise of the world.
Well, it's very true. I mean, the fact that it may have originated in Iran, certainly somewhere in Georgia or, you know, sort of in the Caucasus, is most likely on the Zagros Mountains, is where we have the first evidence of wine, of viniculture. So yeah, Iran is the origin of lots of bad things. It's very true.
So do you think that Iran may have been the source for winemaking?
Well, again, if it's not the origin, it's very close to the origin. And I like to think that Iran is the first country that learned how to make wine, yes, in history, about, you know, say 8,000-9,000 years ago.
Yes.
That, those are the first sites that have been excavated with remnants of a liquid that has proven to be wine and urns and, you know, things like that.
So what are you going to do next? You've done so many lectures, so many books you've edited. I saw one lecture that I would really have liked to have visited, which was Women Entertainers in Safavid Iran.
Right, yeah, that's mostly about prostitution and sort of public women and dancers and singers, you know, things like that. Well, different things. I just finished an article about women in the Safavid period, sort of common women. What has been published so far is mostly on court women, you know, the elite. So I sort of collected all the material that I could find on ordinary women, so to speak. And I constructed an article with the idea of the veil, you know, which women veiled at the time, and are there differences to be found between elite and common women and Muslim and non-Muslim women and so forth. And I just finished that. And next, my next project, which I'm also working on a little bit, and I've already published on too, a couple of articles, is the Iranian perception of the West and how it evolved over time.
Fantastic. Yes, I'd love to read that.
This whole notion of, you know, again, this filled, I mean, Iranian culture is filled with ambiguity, you know. So there's this repulsion and attractiveness of the West, you know, and it goes back really to the Safavid period. You know, on the one hand, we love Americans, and the other hand, we, you know, we think they're all out to get us, and, you know, it's one big foreign conspiracy. So again, these two poles, you know, filtered ambiguity. So I'm tracing this whole thing back to 1500. Can't go much beyond that in terms of the sources, but you see all these patterns, you know, how the British were seen, and the Russians, and then the Germans, and the from 1907 until 1940, and then after World War II, the Americans, you know. And again, it's this push and pull, attractiveness and rejection at the same time.
Do you ever find that things that are going on with American politics sometimes echo what's happened in the past? For example, I don't want to really get political, but I know Obama said that if he got into power, he would attack the Middle East to defend Israel. And I wondered if that was something that they'd always done. They'd always gone to push back the boundaries in the Middle East to protect what their own interests were.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, well, the Americans were not on the scene until World War II, really. You know, they left the place of the British. And then, of course, it's always been, well, the two issues, of course, oil and Israel, there's no question about it. So Obama has to says what he has to say in order to get elected, you know, for obvious reasons.
Mm.
How this will work out remains to be seen, of course. But yeah, the Americans have, you know, empires tend to make the same mistakes over and over and over again anyway. But I do think the British were a little cleverer than the Americans, who just don't learn because they have this black and white view of the world and themselves. And, you know, it's not very helpful, you know, in a complex world.
I think that's why our English teacher at school made us read Waterlands, because it was all about how history just repeats itself. But you could actually,
right.
History was a really important subject to learn from, and it wasn't a dead subject. Is that how you got into it? Not through Graham Swift, but something that kind of attitude.
Sorry, yeah, I've read Waterland, and I saw the movie too, but I'm not sure what your last question was.
Just how did you get into history, and do you feel
history? Well, I don't have a good and straight answer, you know. I actually came to America in 1984 with the idea of doing history. I had done, you know, what we still called at the time sort of, you know, Oriental languages and cultures, meaning, you know, I'd studied Arabic, I'd live in Egypt, I'd studied Persian, I'd live in Iran. So it's sort of a grab bag of language and culture and literature and so forth. It's not very well defined, comes out of the 19th century. And I applied to an Islamic studies department at UCLA, but I ended up working with Nikki Keddie, who's a solid historian, and she made me into a historian, clearly. And I, you know, came to appreciate history, and even though my degree, I'm not a historian, because I graduated, so I wrote my thesis. I mean, my degree is a PhD in Islamic studies. But I, you know, ever since I wrote my thesis, I felt a historian, and I think like a historian. I hope I do, at least, sort of combining both the grand sweep and the micro history, and trying to make sense of it, looking at patterns, and at the same time, you know, realizing that history is both, you know, repetition and something completely new all the time. So it's not as though, you know, my father was a historian or anything like that. I've always had an interest in it, of course.
Well, how did you get interested in Islam and the Middle East then? Because Netherlands has always been somewhere that has had a very matter-of-fact attitude towards the Middle East, even
right.
Going to, you know, with Theo van Gogh, who made that film, and then
right.
With,
sure.
You
sure.
Know...
Mission, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, again, a bit of an unusual story on the one hand, and fairly typical on the other hand, because I think very few people sort of knew at age 8 that they wanted to become whatever they ended up becoming. In my case, it went through, you know, classical high school gymnasium, where I, you know, continental European education until the 1960s, you know, where you would learn Latin and Greek for 5 years. And so I studied Greek, and I read about the Persians, you know, the wars against the Persians 500 BC, Herodotus and Xenophon and so forth, and sort of, you know, awaken an interest in the other side. It was all written from the Greek perspective, of course. And I was curious about, you know, what the Persians had to say. So I sort of drifted in that direction, and then I graduated from high school, didn't quite know what to do university-wise. You know, a lot of things I thought were boring, and a lot of things I didn't qualify for, and, you know. And so I inquired about, you know, these funny languages, and then they told me, well, you know, you can do... I actually wanted to do ancient Persia because of the Greek connection. They said, well, if you're independently wealthy, that might be an option, but if you're not, it's probably not advisable to do that. So why don't you look into, you know, modern Iran? There's a whole country out there, and there's, you know, a lot of interest, and there's oil. This is 1972. And then you have to learn Arabic or Turkish. So, you know, I sort of got into it that way. And then I ended up going to Iran after my bachelor's degree, and I loved it. It was very difficult. I hated it, and I loved it at the same time.
In 76?
Yes, last days of the Shah, in retrospect. It was overheated, you know, totally...
So that's quite interesting. In America, you choose your subject according to your financial status, because it has more of a fruitful... Well, I mean, suppose that's the same in any country, but they actually said to you, if you're financially independent, study this unknown, sort of not much investigated subject.
Right.
And if you haven't got money, then choose something more lucrative. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's been true everywhere to some degree, you know. I mean, I'm a product of the 60s and the 70s, and we weren't terribly concerned about careers. But, you know, to sort of dive into something without any kind of sense of what it might generate over time, I've always been just too pragmatic for that. Anyway, you know, it looked interesting, even though I had no idea what I was getting into.
That's a brilliant story. Brilliant. That's okay. Finally, then, if people were interested in following a kind of path like yours, what Greek writers should they read in order to who reference the Persian scholars? Because like, we all know that the Greeks took a lot of learning from the Zoroastrians when Alexander invaded.
Yes, I'm not sure if I can recommend any Greek authors, really. I think it might be much more fruitful and productive to go straight to the source, you know. Start reading your Rumi, you know.
But I mean in terms of how Western science and Western understanding came from the Greeks, but what did the Greeks take then from the Persians? Because that hasn't been much.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
But a couple of interesting books. You know, a book came out a few years ago. I forget the name of the author, to tell you the truth. It's a British guy. It's called Zoroastrianism. And it really talks about it. It's very accessible. It's sort of, you know, popular history. But, you know, in the good sense of the word, it's full of information about Zoroastrianism as one of the first revealed religions and what it gave to the world. And, you know, the whole idea of Satan and angels and the idea of an afterlife and good and evil being reproduced in our own selves and how we have to fight the battle ourselves, all these ethical questions, they all came from Persia or Iran. And that might not be a bad start, you know, if you want to get into this whole thing.
Definitely, I'll look it up.
Yes.
Well, Rudy, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thank you very much.